You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
We are back with another edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. A bit of a different twist to this one. It's a rebranding. It's a return. We went away for a little while, and now we're coming back like Marshawn Brooks emerging back from China with the Memphis Grizzlies, returning with a passion. Back with my new co-host, Marcus Barahal. Marcus, what's going on, buddy?
Josh, it is good to be on this side of the hosting of this podcast. I'm excited to take over and to help you usher Locked On Nets into a new era.
Yeah, a new era. You know, I feel like we need a slogan. Maybe we should just adapt the We Go Hard from the Nets.
We could do that. We go pretty hard, the two of us.
Yeah, we do. What do you think of that, by the way? Like having how each team has their own hashtag? Because I think it's so ridiculous how you'll see like Nets down 17, hashtag We Go Hard. But and maybe it is good for branding.
Yeah, I think the idea is good. When I worked at the NBA, actually, we were like asked to create different hash emojis, as they're called, for the NBA All-Star game for different players. So like for Boogie, you could have like a ghost because he's a like a boogie monster, that type of stuff, like Anthony Davis, a unibrow. So I like the idea behind it. I'm not sure We Go Hard is like kind of generic and doesn't make me think of Brooklyn necessarily. I would maybe think of something more specific.
Well, it's supposed to be like the song, right? Like Brooklyn, we go hard. Yeah, I feel like I was looking at some of them yesterday. Some of them are just like hashtag Rockets or what's the Knicks one? I'm blanking. Some of them are good.
I don't even know the Knicks one. It's like Take New York or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like some of the classic ones are like Take Note for the Jazz.
That one's good. I like that one.
Cuss Cries for the Celtics. I missed the Knicks Bone Goal one when we had the Nets Bone Goal one. The playoffs. When they put the B in the wrong place. Anyways, so let's talk a little bit about this this great weekend that the Nets had. Two victories. Really one of the first times we can say that in a while. The Nets break their extremely long, I think it was 33 or 34 games of losing the second half of a back-to-back on the road. And even though this one was in the in New York, it wasn't in Brooklyn, it wasn't in their borough, so it still counts as a road win, and they break that curse. So great things on all those fronts. And obviously the signature win in that is really the defeat of the Toronto Raptors, who came into that game at 21-5, probably the clear best team in the Eastern Conference. And Marcus, I know you love the Raptors, so it made me feel extra happy that the Nets got the win over your boys, so we could kind of show you what we're bringing to the table.
Yeah, the Nets beat both of my teams back-to-back here, took down the Raptors and then the Knicks. I also remember last year, you and I saw the Nets and the Raptors play in person. So just real great memories.
D'Angelo Russell game.
Yeah, the D'Angelo Russell game. That was honestly one of the most exciting moments of my life, basketball-wise, of just being at a game in person. He could not miss that game.
That was crazy. Yeah, I feel like he always has good games against them for whatever reason.
He put up 29 in the overtime game, and I thought the Nets' effort against the Knicks on Saturday was especially impressive considering the overtime and considering that they had that double overtime game against the Grizzlies like a couple days ago, maybe a week ago. So just impressed with the effort all around.
Yeah, and I think the Nets did a good job in this one. You know, the Raptors could have definitely won that game. I think that they had a lot of opportunities to do so. Kawhi Leonard in the overtime missing two pretty open 18-footers. And if you give him a couple chances at that, usually he's not going to miss. The refs kind of blowing that call. Was there ever a reason why the shot clock reset to 24? I think it was at the end of the fourth quarter, but it was the play where D'Angelo Russell tried to save it. There should have been like 7 seconds left, and they just reset it to 24, allowing Toronto to get the last shot. And Kenny Atkinson doesn't complain about it. I mean, what is this guy doing? Because it happened against the Cavs also, where the ball went out of bounds with 0.01 second. Clearly, it should have been 0.5 or 0.6, and no one on the coaching staff says anything. I'm like, what's going on here?
Yeah, there's like a new wave of coaches like Brad Stevens and Steve Kerr and Kenny Atkinson to a degree who are kind of just very calm on the mm-hmm. sideline, very even-keeled, which is definitely needed at times. But there needs to be a time where you just kind of snap like Rick Carlisle would or like Greg Popovich would, and just you just can't hesitate to just chew a ref out if it's a clear miscall.
Yeah, I think maybe what he needs to start doing is just sick Spencer Dinwiddie on him, just because Spencer has already lost all credibility with the ref. So it's like, okay, just keep complaining about the calls not related to your drives to the basket. Maybe just in general when the refs fuck up and say, hey, I'm just going to use you as my designated kind of complainer of the team, so to speak, as another value that he provides.
Yeah, almost like in the Key and Peele sketch with the Obama's anger translator. I think Kenny Atkinson needs one of those.
Yeah, yeah. And if you haven't seen that sketch, that's some homework for you guys to do after the podcast, and we will be issuing a quiz for our next episode. Yep. So Raptors game, really good. Nets break that 8-game losing streak. And definitely so many heartbreakers along the 8-game skid that great to see them win a clutch game. D'Angelo Russell had a pretty good game, I think, really scoring the ball. 29 points on 22 shots is very good for him. Hitting a couple mid-rangers. Did have some crucial turnovers, one at the end of, towards the end of overtime, where he kind of just dribbled the ball off his foot and wasn't passing that much. And I think Spencer Dinwiddie also, just tendency to play hero ball amongst the Nets. And they're a team that really has to kind of execute on their system and run that Chris ball movement. If they don't, they just don't have a chance, especially without LeVert. So, Marcus, you're a pretty good street ball player. How can the Nets start executing more in late game situations? I'm sick of this.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing late game wise is just to not be too predictable. And I think that when you've got Dinwiddie just dribbling at the top, the defense kind of knows what to expect. I think the more motion and the more confusion you can generate, the better it'll be for your offense. So I think whether that's sending Joe Harris or Allen Crabbe around screens that don't necessarily result in anything, but just kind of turn the defense's head for a split second while Jared Allen comes up to set a pick mm-hmm. or something, just as much confusion and chaos as you can cause usually benefits the offense late in games.
Yeah, no, I like that. I think kind of, even though the main action is going to be your 1-5 pick and roll, just having your shooters run off screens, maybe he's hoping someone gets lost and there's a mismatch that you can really explore. So yeah, Marcus already coming up with good ideas on the podcast. So we'll take a quick break here and then come back, and I will rub in the Nets win over the Knicks a little bit more and really kind of get to Marcus, hopefully, and see if we can make him snap on the first episode. Locked On Nets segment 2. Let's talk a little bit about the 112-104 win over the New York Knicks. This was one of my favorite games of the season because, one, I hate the Knicks as much as I love the Nets, so seeing them get that win was great. I think, honestly, the worst loss of the season for me was when they got blown out by the Knicks, not any of these most recent heartbreaking games. So really nice performance by the Nets. Spencer Dinwiddie was the standout in this one, 25 points on 10 of 17 from the basket, and really he was doing it by just driving to the rim, schooling Mitchell Robinson time and time again, blowing by your precious French Frank on multiple occasions. And then some nice supporting performances. Allen Crabbe, 17 points, 5 of 5 from 3. He's been on a tear from three-point land, up to 38% on the season, even though we won't talk about his disastrous two-point percentage. And Rondae Hollis-Jefferson also hitting a couple threes. So definitely some positive signs from the Nets. I think the Knicks also... couple of good takeaways from them that I think Mitchell Robinson's definitely going to be a good player over time once he learns to not foul every possession. Dodson impressed me, Trier impressed me also. So they have a couple of nice pieces on the margins that could end up being rotational guys. So definitely not all is lost for the Knicks as well. But Marcus, give me some high-level takeaways from this game.
Yeah, I feel like every time I watch Mitchell Robinson, he either has 5 fouls or 5 blocks. Mm-hmm. This was a fouls game. Yeah, sometimes both. He had 5 fouls, only 4 points, so not great. From the Nets side, it was definitely very encouraging, obviously, to see Crabbe and Rondae combine to go 7-for-7 from 3. I'm not sure if that's ever happened. I looked it up. This was for Rondae Hollis-Jefferson. Only the 5th time in his career that he's made multiple threes in a game, which is not great, considering I think he's in his 4th year. But it's a good sign. I think he's made 5 already in December, so maybe he's turning a corner there. Dinwiddie was awesome. I mean, 25 points off the bench is impressive regardless. And this is like the other side of that hero ball that we talked about earlier, where when it works, it looks really good and it leads to wins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think against a team like the Knicks that has such a poor pick and roll defense, it can work oftentimes. Yeah, I mean, Rondé, really the three-point shot for me is going to be his swing skill. Just going 2 of 2 from in a game isn't going to really kind of erase his track record of poor performance over the last couple of years, especially because it's not like his form looks so improved. I mean, can you have an effective shot just with that kind of form? I feel like his touch isn't that bad, but it just looks so weird coming out of his hand, and I feel like he needs to be 100% set wide open to even have a chance at hitting it.
Yeah, and we talked about this with Jared Allen on the last podcast, where a lot of the threat of the three-pointer isn't necessarily making them at like a decent rate. It's the fact that you're willing to take them. So the 2 for 2, while it's nice that he made 2, I'd almost rather him go like 3 for 7.
Mm-hmm.
It's because then that means he's taking more. That means the defense has to close out that much harder, which for a player who's as explosive as Rondé, would give him that extra half step to burst by and either create for himself or to pass.
Yeah, but what is it going to take? Because I feel like guys like Rondé Hollis-Jefferson, they have such a reputation of being non-shooters. It's almost like in a game, it's not really going to change anything. He has to kind of go a whole season of shooting a lot of threes and hitting them at a respectable clip for guys to even think about closing out on him, just because NBA players are smart and they're not going to kind of react to 1 or 2 shots for the most part. I think it was one of the Ringer pods that they were talking about. Aaron Gordon was ripping threes to start, I guess, last season or 2 seasons ago at a 45% clip, and still no one would close out on him. So it's nice that he's hitting them. Again, the space is more important, but I feel like it's going to take so long for him to garner that respect, even if he can hit them at a reasonable clip. I just don't know if it's ever going to click for RHJ, even though I love the guy.
Yeah, it's like they talk about on one of our favorite shows, Survivor. Perception mm-hmm. is reality. And if the defense doesn't think Rondé can make them, they're not going to guard him. And so they're not going to give that space, even if he is hitting them at a decent rate. It's like the Rondo thing, where he's making around like 36% of his threes, but they're all wide open. So it's not as big of an impact.
Yeah, I feel like there are a lot of point guards like that now. Like Ish Smith can hit shots. Rondo, as you mentioned, a lot of guys can kind of step up and knock down a 25-footer and really...
Yeah, Rubio stepped it up.
Yeah, Rubio. It doesn't change the pick-and-roll coverage at all, which is interesting. Yeah, a couple other takeaways from this one. Enes Kanter, I don't know how this guy is so good against the Nets, but really, Jared Allen couldn't stop him. And what Allen was doing is that Kanter would catch the ball at like the free throw line or maybe top of the key and look for cutters, and Allen would just play completely off in the paint. And then once Kanter didn't have anyone, because I think the Nets' off-ball defense was excellent in this game, D'Lo, Crabbe, Joe Harris really getting after it, not allowing open catch and shoot opportunities, digging over screens. I think the intensity was probably the best I've seen it all year. But Kanter would just take it into Allen's shoulder, and he would have 8 or 10 feet of just free runway to gain ahead of steam. I don't know. I think Allen, he is very athletic and agile. So maybe if he goes to a more aggressive defensive scheme, he can still compensate with his speed and his length, as opposed to kind of, I feel like the defense he was playing is something that you'd want to see out of Brook Lopez, where he is very long but doesn't have any sort of foot speed to compensate and add to that.
Yeah, Kanter's very thick, and I think that...
Multiple Cs.
So many Cs. I think that Allen and the Nets have kind of struggled against those bigger centers like Kanter and Vucevic in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I kind of want to see Allen try fronting a little more and maybe more like ball denial.
Yeah.
I would like to see him take on more of like a KG mentality. Not that he's going to be that kind of defender, like one of the best defenders of all time, but just like a guy who's that height and who isn't necessarily physically strong, but is able to kind of use his quickness and his athleticism to deny the ball and deny shots from even getting off.
Yeah, that's fair. And could KG build computers? I don't think so. So clearly Allen has the intellect.
For sure.
Marcus, another point I want to get your thoughts on here, because we haven't heard from you all season. We had Gavin's takes, which are of course great and unique, and we all love the guy and wish him very well at Locked On Knicks. But what is your take on the 4 rotation? Because it's kind of a mess. We have RHJ starting now. It was Dudley for a lot of the season, the much maligned Jared Dudley, and Damari Carroll's in the mix. Kurucs is a guy that a lot of people love, and he's getting some playing time now, and he has a lot of frenetic energy out there. But amongst those four fours, what would you want the minutes distribution to be going forward?
Well, I think it should all be about the young guys at this point. I don't think you really gain anything from playing Jared Dudley, and I don't think you gain a ton from playing Damari Carroll. I think those guys are good to have on your roster, and if it's a blowout or if it's like every once in a while to get the minutes just to keep them engaged, I think that's a smart idea, but I think that Rondé and Karuk should pretty much just be splitting it. I would say I would give Rondé pretty much like 30 minutes at the four, and then give Karuk maybe like 20 minutes total.
Really? Okay. So you don't, is there any point in, like, I know a lot of people are talking about saying, hey, we need to pump up Carroll's trade value and play him. I feel like, is there any point of that? Is there any like tangible impact? Is there going to be an increased value in the trade package the Nets could get for Carroll, if anything, just by playing him more minutes?
I don't personally think so. I mean, there's still teams that are trying to trade for J.R. Smith, even though he hasn't played in a while. I think people know what Carroll is. I don't think there needs to be like any more tape or anything. Mm-hmm. I think if anything, yeah, I guess he could see a little bit of a boost to his value if he puts up some numbers or if he gets hot shooting. But at the same time, you're running a risk where if he goes out and shoots 0 for 3 from 3 like he did against the Knicks, then maybe teams aren't as interested as they would have been.
Mm-hmm. And also, he has so many, he's so injury prone, has so many miles on him. It's also like we're preserving him for you by like keeping him on the bench. And he's that car that we're keeping in the garage because we don't want any dents or anything to happen. So just like maybe raising the price that way. But I don't know. He's a competitor. I think he could help a team in like a 10 to 12 minute capacity. Maybe the Rockets would look at him. I feel like a team like Utah could be interesting for him. Maybe Lakers, even if they just want a minor piece instead of going for Ariza, who might be a bit more difficult to poach away from Phoenix. So we'll see. So we're going to go with a new segment here on the Locked On Nets podcast. It's something that came to me while I was drinking a cappuccino from Starbucks, and it's called The Quick Two. Because basically every podcasting segment that anyone has ever done is they just think of NBA puns and then or NBA like phrasing and language, and then say, okay, we have what it's going to be called. Now let's make a segment out of it.
So yeah, you can reverse engineer it.
Reverse engineer it, exactly. So what the quick two is going to be, it's going to be two quick Nets questions that we're going to do once a week. And these aren't going to be like, is Damari Carroll going to get traded, D'Lo or Spencer Dinwiddie? Something that is a little bit less talked about, and we'll see how quickly we run out of topics. But for now, quick two, first one. Marcus, would you do this if you were Kenny Atkinson and if you were the Nets? Because clearly he's a very good developmental guy, but he might not be the best in-game coach. I'm thinking and proposing we give Kenny Atkinson a small raise, so he's making $2.5 million now. We say, Kenny, we're going to bump up your contract for another year or two. We're going to, instead of $2.5 million a year, it's going to be $3 million a year. But instead of being the head coach, you're going to be the co-head coach, focused on development, and now we're going to bring in an analytical guy, someone who can handle the in-game, the timeouts, there's more of the strategy of the whole matter, and you two are going to be the co-head coaches moving forward.
That's super interesting. I really like the idea. I think that Kenny's definitely great at development, as we've seen with LeVert and Allen, guys who were picked later that kind of have reached what their ceiling was thought to be, and I'm super interested to see how he handles having a top-end pick this year if the Nets do end up with a high pick. The only question I would have about the co-head coaches is, A, if you had anyone specific in mind, and B, if players like had questions or problems, would they go to both coaches? Would they go to one? Would that end up tearing the locker room apart?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. So really the way I'm envisioning it is that in those 2.5 hours, if you have a question, you go to the in-game head coach. So let's say the game starts at 7:30. From 7:20-ish to when the game ends, you're going to the in-game head coach. Anything outside of that, you're going to Kenny Atkinson. It's a question about practice. It's a question about workouts, dietary. Atkinson, because he's a developmental guy. In-game is the in-game guy, who is going to be myself in this scenario.
Wow, you're just going to leave me after one podcast.
Ooh, I could co-host on the side. Or maybe maybe Puccio or someone like that. Someone who I trust.
Smart guy.
Yeah, I think I'm surprised that the, and this is a bit different, but I guess it has kind of been over the years a bit more prevalent in the NBA, but obviously the offensive defensive coordinator system in the NFL, now you hear things teams talking. I feel like it started around Tibbs, like, oh, he's the Celtics defensive coordinator before he got that Bulls job. Now I forget the name of the Rockets guy that they just brought back. What was his name? The defensive coordinator guy?
Yeah, I can't remember. I know Ron Adams is the guy for the Warriors.
Yeah, Ron Adams. Yeah, a bunch of teams have these. So just more specialization, because Kenny Atkinson is – Jeff Bezdelic is the name of the Rockets guy. But coaches are doing so much. You need to have a bit more specialization in play. And instead of saying, hey, Popeye Jones, you're going to be our big man coach. Like, do you need a big man coach? No, we need an in-game timeout coordinator. So that's what I'm proposing. And this hasn't been a quick first question, but that's kind of going to be the gist of the questions moving forward. Something a bit more abstract that we can really sink our teeth into.
Also, I just wanted to add, I know it's supposed to be quick and we've already made
it. No, go for it.
Super long. But I also would really love to see more player coaches. A guy like LeBron is definitely capable of doing it. I don't know if the Nets have anyone currently who could be capable. Maybe Jared Dudley.
Yeah, Dudley.
Taking over as head coach.
Well, I feel like Dudley's better suited for player announcer, where he announces while he's playing. Yeah, no.
I can do all three, honestly.
I mean, based on the Elton Brand, J.J. Redick podcast, like, they were grooming Elton Brand to be the GM when he was still a member of the 76ers. Yeah, who would be the worst player coach?
Ooh, net specific or just in general?
In general.
It's a good question. Markel Fultz wouldn't be great.
Yeah, not great. I feel like Jimmy Butler might be the worst, actually.
He'd be very Tibbs-like, I think.
Yeah, I think he'd be worse than Tibbs. Or he'd be like a Jim Boylan at this point. Like, they just revolt on him after one game.
I could see that. I could see him rubbing some people the wrong way.
Yeah. Or maybe like Nick Young or someone like that. Newly signed Denver Nugget Nick Young. Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe I'll think of the coming days my list of top five and top five best and top five worst player coaches.
I'll come up with a list.
Mm-hmm. So question two is going to be 1 minute left in the game. It's tied. Would you rather have Jared Allen or Ed Davis on the court?
I'm going to use the same logic that I used when you asked about the four rotation. I'm going to say Jared Allen. I think that even though Davis is probably more seasoned and more polished right now, and he might like know intuitively what to do more, I think the only way that Allen's going to get up on that level is if you play him more. And he's a better shooter. He, I think, is just as capable defensively. And I don't see any reason why you would bench him late.
Yeah, no, I feel like if it's a developmental setting, I definitely agree, Jared Allen. I don't know, I love Ed Davis, man. Like, he's just so good, and his free throw stroke is terrible, and that's really the only thing holding him back from being, in my opinion, someone that actually could be a starter on another team, if someone just looking for a stopgap type player. But yeah, Jared Allen is less of a liability from the line, but Ed Davis is just so smart defensively, such a great rebounder, always in the right spot. And he's a decent finisher around the rim, so I've been really impressed with him. I think he's probably my favorite signing, my favorite new net in a while, just from love what we've seen from the guy.
Yeah, Davis, he really reminds me of who the Knicks used to have for a while, just like a solid big man who can be your third big and just come in and contribute.
Yeah, no, those guys I feel like are missed in the league now, just because everyone's trying to get those like either like rail thin guys who can shot block and roll to the rim, or someone that can shoot threes. They're really the backup center that is a very solid rebounder, good positional defender, and can finish around the basket. That's kind of becoming a lost art, so to speak.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's guys right now who currently fill that role, like Zach Collins and Jakob Poeltl, but I think that the Spurs and the Blazers respectively both hope that those guys develop into starters. I don't know who like the next young backup big man who would like fill that role is.
Yeah, we need more Ed Davises.
Maybe Willie Hernan Gomez.
I could see that. He's also going to be the lead recruiter for every team trying to chase a star.
I saw that.
Apparently, he's a great personality.
Seems like a nice guy.
Yeah, no, it's good. I feel like we need to reunite him and Juancho Hernan Gomez. I love when brothers are on the same team, besides the Morai, because Morai are too attached that I want to actually separate them. But everyone else, I think it's fun when they're together.
Yeah, anytime you share a bank account with your brother, that's a little too far.
Yeah, that's crazy. Do we think they still do that?
I don't know.
Can they even?
Yeah, that would probably be weird for, like, you'd have to call the credit card company, I'd think, because they'd be using it in, like, different states all the time.
Yeah, I feel like Boston, I mean, I'm assuming Marcus Morris uses TD Bank, and I feel like I'm in D.C. now. I'm actually recording this from a D.C. hotel room. I don't think there's not a lot of TDs here. I mean, maybe Markeith's using something regional in addition to a TD, or he's using Chase, but not sure on the Morris Bank account front. We'll have to touch base with Gavin, as we know he spent 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns and has a better grasp on that than either Marcus or I could ever dream of. So, Marcus, any final thoughts? How do we feel quick two went? I think it went well.
I think it was good. I think we got a basket with maybe like 8 seconds different between the shot clock and the game clock. So I think we'll get it back for another possession.
Yeah, and then some weeks when it goes long, if we replicate this next week, it will be the long two, which is something that we know we don't want. So it's an incentive for us to keep it short.
Yeah, we do not want a foot on the line Carmelo Anthony jumper.
Ooh, hate to see that. So that's going to wrap it up here. Guys, we're going to try to have a bit more engagement. So we're going to try to ramp that up from nothing to something. Tweet at us at Locked On Nets. My handle is at JMBass_. Marcus is at Marcus Barahal. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay.
Barahal.
So follow our boy Marcus. We're going to be tweeting at you, trying to get some good facts, some good stuff, some lists. We'll follow up on our top five best and worst player coaches list. And looking forward to what the rest of the season has in store for us. And we will probably be back in a couple days to discuss the game against Philly and other findings we're seeing across the NBA and in Nets land. Thank you guys for all your support, and take care.